You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, wanted for war crimes, Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir touches down at the African Union summit in South Africa amid outrage from the international community, and then swiftly takes off again, scot-free. I'll be asking my guests, James Schneider and Jane Kinnemont, should the South Africans be doing more? Also on the show, France and Italy are squabbling about the responsibility over migrants in the Med. We'll be asking who's right and what can be done to move on the debate. We'll also be discussing our favourite endangered neighbourhood eating spots, threatened by increasing rents and shrinking profits. Why are some choosing to shut up shop altogether rather than adapt? All that, plus a puppy who's stuck in the doghouse en route from the US at Barcelona Airport. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to Midori House, and my guest today, Jane Kinnemont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and James Schneider, Editorial Director at New African Magazine. Welcome both to the show. South Africa Day has found itself stuck in the middle of an argument between the International Criminal Court and Sudan. The latter's president, Omar al-Bashir, is wanted on charges of crimes against humanity and genocide during the ongoing conflict in Darfur by the ICC, and he's been wanted for 6 years. On Saturday, he landed in South Africa, one of the 123 nations bound by the Rome Statute of 1998 to uphold the court's jurisdiction. For the African Union summit, he was attending it rather, and then promptly left again unchallenged, despite requests from the international community calling for his arrest. So why was Bashir allowed to enter South Africa in the first place, and why was he not arrested? James, why were the South Africans so reluctant to get involved?
Well, there are at least sort of two reasons. Firstly, the ANC has decided, as have many ruling parties across the continent, that the ICC, they don't really want to deal with it anymore. The ANC statement is it's, quote, no longer useful. So they aren't really going to, even though they've signed up the Rome Statute, even though their constitution says that they have to abide by the international agreements they've signed, and they have signed this, they've said that basically, they don't think the court's any good, so they're not going to bother with it. The second thing is they have argued that anybody who comes to South Africa for the African Union summit has immunity because they're not coming to South Africa, they're coming to the African Union building. That's the argument that they've constructed. So much like when some people go to the US, to go to New York, to go to the UN, they've argued that they're not really going to South Africa. So that's been the sort of the main reason why they've allowed it to happen, and then the sort of legal niceties they've used. Then a South African human rights organisation put an application in to a court in Pretoria saying that Bashir should be arrested. Now, the court obviously didn't have time to decide whether he should be arrested or not, but they thought that the case was sufficiently important that Bashir should not be allowed to leave the country. So the court in South Africa said that the South African government had to hold Bashir in the country until they could make a judgment on whether he should be sent to The Hague or not. But whilst that was all coming out, Bashir left the country, flew out this morning, and the South African Justice Ministry sort of said, well, he's not here anymore, so we're not going to hold him.
So, Jane, for South Africa, two interesting things. Well, two interesting things for South Africa and the rest of the world. First, for the ICC, does this mean it has, you know, no value going forward? And even for its local judiciary, does this mean that, you know, that's failed as well?
Well, the ICC has managed to summon a variety of politicians who aren't heads of state. It might be that it's overreached in an international system where state sovereignty still plays a massive role. I don't see a precedent anywhere else for actually successfully managing to bring a serving head of state to trial, but it's still proving to be an important force with somewhat lower level officials and leaders, for example, in Kenya. There's still a wider debate, though, about whether this international justice makes conflicts more difficult to resolve. There's been a whole debate over whether Bashar Assad of Syria, for instance, should be referred to the ICC. Those who are opposed to that say it would make it even more unlikely that he would ever willingly step down.
James, the interesting thing here is I know that there's been much criticism of the ICC. I think many people in Africa feel that it's, yes, good at targeting African leaders, but its remit doesn't seem to go anywhere else. The focus of the ICC seems to be too Africa-focused. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
Yes, every single case that the ICC has at the moment is on an African individual. So, you know, by definition, not 100% of the worst crimes that have been committed in the world in the last 10 or 15 years have been committed on the African continent or been committed by Africans on the African continent. So, yes, the basic criticisms of the ICC, how it has only targeted African states, it can only target particular crimes, how it seems to be unable to challenge others, bring others to court, how the US is not a signatory to the Rome Statute. All of these things are very legitimate criticisms of the ICC. The ICC also has a political tin ear. It plays politics very badly, especially how it played it in Kenya. It's really lost the African Union, the African Caucus of signatories, which was the largest in the world. The you know, African states were the biggest to sign up, and also did refer a number of cases to the International Criminal Court. But it has profoundly failed. But that doesn't mean that either in the case of Uhuru Kenyatta in Kenya or Omar al-Bashir, that the fact that this is a very flawed court that has played its hand badly, that doesn't mean that therefore they should be allowed to get off from any charges scot-free, because the only institution that can try to bring them to justice is a flawed one, because the alternative is no institution. That is an even more flawed situation.
Jane, on that subject, do you think it's important, if you know these governments don't want to support the ICC in their bid to bring the Sudanese president to court, to trial, that they do have some other kind of mechanism that shows that the continent as a whole is good at policing itself? And I think that's what outsiders who watch worry, that there is a little bit of sympathy, collusion, kind of, or just disinterest in what happens on the continent. And so you can have somebody who is accused of genocide who is actually welcomed when he arrives in South Africa.
The African Union has developed some mechanisms to deal with cases where there are coups, but when it comes to internal repression and ethnic cleansing, like you saw in Sudan or Kenya, there is much, much less done in terms of punishment or deterrent. The African Union did send a peacekeeping force into Darfur several years ago. It was pretty small scale. It wasn't big enough for that vast territory. But I guess they have made a call that cooperating with Sudan, they think, is more likely to produce results than excluding them.
And James, we should also point out that actually in Europe, during the period of, you know, sanctions and attempts to bring the Zimbabwe government to heel, you know, you saw Mr. Mugabe popping up in all sorts of places in Europe. He was, even then, people weren't very willing to say, don't come, we don't like what you're doing in your country, you're behaving badly. You know, you'd see him in Paris or in Rome. He still travelled widely, even though the Brits were kind of keen to see action taken against him.
Yes, although there are different cases. I mean, Bashir has charges against him in the International Criminal Court that means all of the signatories are under legal obligation to arrest him and ship him to trial. The difference with Mugabe is Mugabe is not wanted by the ICC or any other international body for those kind of crimes where he has to be arrested. But yes, he and his retinue have been under sanctions, which are slowly being lifted. But these are all political games. They'll try to nip into a country to show that they can and out again. Bashir has been doing this for a long time. He nipped into Nigeria for a little bit last year, and then he was kind of chased away. They test the waters. Bashir, I think it was 2 years ago, applied for a visa to go to the UN, to go to the US, which was rejected. They spend all of their time testing the limits of these constraints that are put upon them.
Well, we're going to move on now and head to Italy, where the country's Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi, is ruffling feathers in Europe and specifically with neighbour France about how to tackle the ongoing migration crisis in the Mediterranean. Those who make it from North Africa to Europe often head through Italy to France, and now 200 are sleeping rough on the streets of the border town Ventimiglia. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is calling for a revision of Europe's policy on migration control, citing its responsibility in the handling of conflicts in North Africa as being part of the push factor for large amounts of people being unsettled and displaced in Europe. France's Interior Minister, Bernard Cazeneuve, has hit back. He says Italy has to turn migrants away in accordance with EU guidelines. So who is right and who should be dealing with the problem? Let's come to you, Jane, first of all. It has become the issue of the last few months, the numbers are ever greater, and it has become seen to be a quite complicated issue because not everybody is coming from Libya, not everyone's coming from Syria. A lot of it is people from much further south in Africa. And European countries don't know how to deal with it. And Italy is right in the forefront. It's got this kind of, it's got a landing strip in effect sticking out into the Mediterranean. So it's dealing with the migration issue. And it rightfully probably feels that that needs to be shared. What's your view on what's been happening today?
Clearly, it is a massively complex international cross-border issue that just isn't within the power of any single government to deal with. So I think Italy does have a case to make that there needs to be burden sharing within Europe. And obviously, it's true that it was particularly France and the UK that really pushed for the intervention in Libya. That said, are they basically saying that if Gaddafi was still there, then this should actually be Libya's responsibility to be the country where all the migrants end up? Many people in Libya are very resentful of that sort of viewpoint coming from Europe.
James, you know, it's interesting because actually when Mr. Gaddafi was still in power, he had an agreement with the Italians. You know, he would send out his boats and he would bring people back to shore. You know, he controlled the movement of people across his nation. And now that's gone, the whole region is opened up to a mass movement of people. I think they have like one boat left to kind of secure their coastal waters, the Libyans. It's not going to stop. So where does this debate have to move to? You need to see some solutions. But the Italian cities are being, they're seeing some real issues about housing people. They're seeing small towns dealing with mass migration. The Italians need somebody to come to their help a little bit, whether that solution is further back in Africa, which is your speciality, or in Europe. What's your take on that?
The European countries have an absolute moral obligation to help any, help those who are crossing and in danger in crossing the Mediterranean. They have a moral obligation to help Italy, which, as you correctly say, faces the kind of brunt of the first impact of this wave of migration that is crossing the Mediterranean. European countries need to come up. They need to, one, put aside the militarized response to attacking smugglers, etc. That will have zero effect on the ground in any positive sense. It's a kind of political smokescreen to make it seem like something is going on. But when a smuggler's ship is a fisherman's ship until the day before it becomes a smuggler's ship, there is no way that you can militarily and effectively target those. And as soon as they become a smuggler's ship, they're full of migrants. So that isn't, you can't shoot them, you can't effectively do that. European countries need to support each other. They need to support France. They need to come up with common rules for who can be accepted, on what conditions, what they can be given, and they need to be shared around the union. The people need to be spread around the union so they're not just concentrated in Italy, because otherwise we're going to end up with a very unpleasant, or even a more unpleasant, because frankly the politics in Europe around this, especially around these migrants, is really inhumane at present. The politics are going to get even more rotten. Italy may turn against the current role it is playing, which is generally pretty positive, and France and the other countries which are basically leaving Italy to bear the brunt may turn even more firmly against them. So they have to do something together.
But it's good to look at the two ends of the scale. So we'll come back to Africa in a moment. But Jane, the interesting thing, okay, there's a moral obligation. We can all understand that and see that you cannot leave people bobbing around in the water, children, mothers. Okay, but let's come to the other end of that equation. You come to a country like France, the Netherlands, Belgium, the UK, where every time there's election now, 50% of the people are voting for right-wing parties who are anti-migration. Here in the UK, 10% went to UKIP in the recent elections, of a really anti-migrant party. The Conservatives have staked their claim to stop migration. Even the Socialists here have said that they want to limit the numbers. You go to communities where people are opposed to more mass migration, where people feel culturally things have changed over the last 10, 20 years, especially in market towns. These people create the moral obligation. But how do you then give these people a life that's more than about saying, come in? But then how can you access them to society? How can you give them school places? How can you give them housing when as a country, you look in London, people cannot find a place to live. And it's extortionate. So what do you think it's not enough just to take people. There has to be more thought about it than that, doesn't there?
Absolutely. You need to, for one thing, it's a long-term issue, but you need to be dealing with some of the root causes that are leading people to feel that they have to flee across the Mediterranean when 1 in 50 people die. It is the case that the two main source countries for migrants coming that way are Syria and are Eritrea. So those people are people who are really coming as political refugees rather than people who are seeking jobs, let alone the kind of caricatures of benefits to tourists. But in the short term, the timings that politicians have to deal with, there is scope, I think, to identify parts of Europe which have less population pressure, less pressure on services and so forth. For instance, Scotland is part of the UK that has very, very low net migration, and where the Scottish National Party's platform included saying that they would be more open to migration. There will be other parts of Europe, not necessarily the economic capitals, that have a somewhat more economically welcoming attitude. And indeed, many European countries could do with an infusion of younger people, because we are also dealing with an ageing population. I think the most creative suggestion I saw was recently in the New York Times, an op-ed entitled, "Let's Resettle Syrian Refugees in Detroit."
Well, I think Mike Bloomberg, the mayor before, said that he feels, who was the mayor of New York, we interviewed him once on Uncle 24, and he said what he would like to see is, come to the US, but you have to live for 1 year in Detroit, and then you can decide where you go. Because he felt that the people who fought their way through to get to the US, even if they were illegal, they were the people who had the gumption to do stuff. They had energy, they had passion, and they could turn around a city like Detroit. James, we do need to move on, but what's terrifying is that the situation in Eritrea, we know, is grim, a form of servitude, everybody doing some odd kind of national service, almost whatever age. The European Union at the moment is putting in millions and millions of investment, even though it's a dictatorship, to try and create some wealth there, create clean water, do all sorts of things. But what do you do? Do you try and solve this problem by supporting these governments? We've just talked about how impossible it is to topple anyone without seeing more repercussions than you imagine. We've talked about what's happening in Sudan, the unwillingness of Africa to take a stand against any of these regimes. It has to be a local solution in the end. Can you see any way through that horrible tangle of opportunities to change things that would be successful?
Well, for Eritrea specifically, there isn't one thing that you can do. I mean, Eritrea doesn't receive large amounts of foreign aid as part of its particular development ideology, or allowing NGOs. It's sort of got a more autarkic philosophy. It's difficult to say exactly what you could do there, but it's not just from Eritrea that migrants are coming. And in fact, there is some evidence to suggest that some of the migrants that are coming, who are technically from Eritrea, but perhaps not from Eritrea, but from neighbouring Sudan or from Ethiopia, or even some from Somalia, because the asylum acceptance rates are higher. So that doesn't mean that they're bogus asylum seekers. They might be coming for perfectly legitimate reasons, but they will have a much better chance for themselves and their families if they say they're Eritrean than something else. But in the longer term, to deal with solutions, there have to be ways in which wealth is less sucked from southern countries where migrants also come up to the global north through undermining economies, through agricultural subsidies in the EU, through unfair trade agreements, through the use of tax havens for multinationals to illicitly transfer financial flows. Those are the sort of long-term things. They're not going to solve anything right now, but those are the sort of things which are going to stop the pull factors of people coming north.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Mindori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, and I'm joined today by Jane Kinnamon and James Schneider. Coming up next, rising rents in our cities and why they're taking an unhealthy bite out of our favourite restaurants.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses, and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Daily sets the agenda in Asia and considers what's been dominating the day in Europe and North America.
The programme is often co-hosted out of our Toronto and New York bureau and features regular interviews with special guests both there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London.
Monocle 24's regular weekly guide to the perfect Friday night in includes some of our favourite cities around the world and features the insights of the people who know those places best, our unrivalled network of correspondents.
Join me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Your regular hosts for the Monocle Daily every weekday at 6 a.m. in Tokyo, 2200 hours in London.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Jane Kinnamont, the Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House, and James Schneider, Editorial Director at New African Magazine. Now, we all know that city living comes at a cost, and the plight of businesses objecting to rising rents, especially in London, is nothing new. But recently, a concerning trend of simply shutting up shop rather than trying to adapt has been taking shape. Now, one such business in London is called Food for Thought, a restaurant that's been going for 40 years and it's going to close down this weekend. The owners have chosen to stop serving rather than raise their prices. Jane, this is a tiny local story in a way, but I think it unfolds in almost every city in the Western world now. What's intriguing about this is we should explain just to listeners, it's not the fanciest of restaurants, it's a health food restaurant. It opened in Covent Garden Market, which is now known for its tourism, but which 40 years ago was just stopping being the fruit and veg market for London. And they opened at a time when it was cheap rents, and they have served kind of wholesome food, flapjacks, God knows what, salads, for all these years. And they've decided that they have a choice because they've got a big rent increase facing them. They can double their prices or they can just stop. And they've decided that they don't want to be part of a society where they have to charge prices they feel uncomfortable with for their food. So they're going to pull out. It's emblematic, do you think, Jane, of, you know, kind of not a particularly just a West End story, but how all our cities are changing around Europe? Because the people who can then afford these rents are always the same companies. You go to every city around the world, it seems to be the same people managing to get in, get their nose in, and independents like this disappear.
Absolutely. There's a weird paradoxical cycle where what makes a lot of cities great is their ability to be mixed, to be creative, to have diversity, and to have small, independent, entrepreneurial organisations that make them different and don't make them just another high street. But then with the mobility of the international rich, and in somewhere like London, the ability of people from all over the world to buy into property, areas and indeed whole city centres can gradually become unaffordable for precisely the people who made them interesting.
James, I wonder if it even impacts your business in a way. It strikes me when I go to somewhere like Stockholm, you're in the centre of Stockholm and you walk past actually quite downtown, an old shop, and you look through the windows and there's a little editorial enterprise running themselves in the heart of downtown from an old store. We were just recently in Lisbon, and this comes up in the quality of life survey we have in the current issue. And I was really struck, downtown, you're next to kind of fancy pants shops, there's the old bookstore still pottering along because rents are really low. We've just done a story about Porto where the social housing rent, people are paying like 60, 70 euros a month for their apartment. And it means that you can, times aren't easy in Portugal, but you can run a business or have a go right in the heart of downtown. You don't have to feel that it's has to be an online business or it has to be kind of pushed to the edge of the city. When you travel around, this is a bit more of a personal take pulling out of your professional world, but are you aware of even how you run your business, where you'd have your offices, how life unfolds in a city like London?
Yes, I think London does have this really big problem where, and you can see it in business, you can see it in culture, where the cost of living is so impossibly high if you aren't making if you aren't making large returns quickly. So that could be a creative endeavor, which maybe you'll get nothing, you know, like you're in a band for 5 years and nothing comes of it, but then something kind of brilliant, or you know, you're part of an art collective and you're basically just not really getting by, or you've got a really interesting business and the cash flow isn't terribly good for a while. Those are, exactly as Jane was saying, the things that make cities great and exciting places to be. And at the moment, because land values are rising so fast, and I think one of the things we have to think about in policy terms is how in certain parts of our cities we can take the land value out of both housing costs and of commercial costs for at least certain types of housing and certain types of business premises, so that we can have a more interesting and more diverse cities where not everybody has to be doing the same thing, whether that's in commerce, whether it's in a creative production, because otherwise they will not be able to pay the rent, not be able to eat, and have to move away.
Now, we have one final story today, which I'm going to subvert, because it's meant to be about this dog. There's a dog that's kind of caught in a kind of some immigration hell, apparently, because of a technological hiccup with its chip in its neck. Anyway, 57,000 people have signed a petition asking for Buddy the dog to be released from Barcelona airport, where it finds itself in a doggy limbo. Jane, I don't really want to talk about this in a way, but what I do want to talk about is, what's intriguing is, over the weekend we had these flash floods which happened in Georgia, in Tbilisi, and they wiped away a zoo, and there were pictures of like the hippo wandering around the town, the bear that had climbed up a... It's interesting, this is a story about migration in a way. This is a story about a blooming dog, and I have a dog and I care about dogs, but this is a story about a dog caught in an airport. We've just been talking about, you know, tens of thousands of real people caught in limbo. When you look at Tbilisi, you know, 13 people, I think, already said to be dead from the flash floods. Everyone's more concerned about the hippo. Do you think, you know, this is because these are the small stories we feel that we can have some impact on, or do you feel that the news agenda has just gone really topsy-turvy?
I think there is a failure.
You care about Buddy the dog, don't you?
Poor
you
Buddy!
You signed. I bet you signed.
Poor Buddy. I think that our imaginations really struggle to cope with the scale of a lot of human tragedies, and that often it is an individual story, because it might sometimes be a child who goes missing that gets this kind of coverage, or a child who's a victim of war. But the thousands and thousands of people affected by migration crises or floods become too much for many people to really think about.
James, the hippo was the ultimate African migrant. He's actually made it all the way to Georgia. He's got through all sorts of customs. Everyone helped him all the way, and he's even been given his freedom of the city in the last few days. When you look at these stories, you know, let's be serious. You're trying to affect the news gender. You see things every day, but you know, and they're not all grim, let's be honest. But you see important things every day. You feel should be grabbing people's attentions. You know, do you just laugh and think it's part of the news cycle that we're concerned about Buddy the dog? Or do you feel actually, when you're trying to change your agenda about Africa, do you sometimes think, okay, this is like just too uphill?
I think it depends. That the odd light-hearted story, there's space for it. No one's head can be entirely filled with trying to work out how to deal with things like migration.
I'm good at lowbrow, don't worry.
But, I mean, there are certain things where it's where resources, journalistic resources, are sucked away from important stories towards ones which are significantly more trivial or have less news value. So things like Buddy the dog, I'm okay with. We're not going to send loads of news packs to go and camp out and find out exactly what's happening with him. But we will send 300 journalists to go and sit in the court with Oscar Pistorius, taking all of international media's Africa budgets with them. And I think those things are more annoying. Buddy the dog, I hope they manage to sort out that chip, but always have a paper backup. That's what he should have had.
He should have applied for a visa long in advance and gone to his embassy, no doubt. But Jane, again, for you at Chatham House, you know, you're spreading, you're doing really interesting research. You're coming across amazing stories. Do you feel that sometimes you always have to have this human angle, this very small way into a story to get it picked up?
Often it's anecdotes and human examples that are what people remember. We've just been having precisely these discussions about our work on environment, resources and climate change. How do you get people interested without an obvious human face and human angle?
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Buddy, I'm sure, will be released soon, thanks to Jane Kinnaman and James Schneider. But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Mariana Zaniga. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Danny Giacopelli is going to be here. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you and goodbye.